For nearly two centuries, societies have weighed the merits of free market capitalism and socialism. Debates continue over which system maximizes prosperity and better promotes human flourishing. Free market capitalism decentralizes economic decisions, giving individuals control over what to produce, how much to charge, and what to buy. Their decisions are informed by market prices, which convey important information about scarcity and consumer value. Proponents contend that capitalism delivers the best economic outcomes by giving individuals incentives to create and produce. Critics, on the other hand, point to the persistence of poverty in market economies and rising inequality as proof that capitalism fails to deliver broad-based prosperity. They maintain that this inequality ultimately gives the rich disproportionate economic and political power. In contrast, socialism grants the government the authority to make most economic decisions. The government chooses how to allocate scarce resources based upon what it determines to be most useful to society as a whole. Proponents argue that socialism ensures society's resources are fairly distributed. Critics claim that socialism fails to give people proper economic incentives to innovate and produce, which ultimately reduces economic opportunities for all. Opponents further argue that socialism's powerful central governments become autocratic and threaten political freedom. So which system is better for humanity? For as long as this question has been asked, the debate all too often devolves into name-calling and emotional arguments that fail to advance the discussion. And yet, it is imperative that we keep asking. The Human Prosperity Project at the Hoover Institution seeks to overcome these preconceptions. It employs analysis of free market capitalism and socialism and its many variants to assess how each system affects human flourishing.
Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are viewing this, and welcome back to the Hoover Institution's Human Prosperity Project. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. I'll be your moderator today. This speaker series is based on the scholarly research and commentary written by Hoover fellows participating in the Human Prosperity Project on Socialism and Free Market Capitalism. The goal of this project is to investigate the historical record to assess the consequences for human welfare, individual liberty, and interactions between nations of various economic systems. This project is research-based with educational and policy-oriented outputs that include long-form essays, short videos, commentary, and in this case, the speaker series, all of which can be found at the Hoover Institution's website, and the address you want to go to is hoover.org/Human Prosperity Project. Let me repeat that. hoover.org/Human Prosperity Project. As a reminder, we will be taking audience questions in about 20 minutes or so. So I encourage you to submit yours now sooner rather than later. And you couldn't do that any easier than going to the Q&A button at the bottom of the screen, typing in your questions, saying it to us, and we will get it lined up for our guests. As for our guests today, I'm joined today by two Hoover colleagues, John Kogan and Josh Rao. They're with us today to discuss impacts of government-sponsored programs with a focus on universal basic income, or UBI for short, and income and wealth taxation. Both John and Josh have written papers on their topics, and they will be available online for your reading. John Kogan is the Leonard and Shirley Eli Senior Fellow here at the Hoover Institution and a faculty member in the Public Policy Program at Stanford University. John's research is focused on U.S. budget and fiscal policy, federal entitlement programs, and healthcare. If you haven't read it already, you should go out and get his latest book, which is called The High Cost of Good Intentions. It traces the history of U.S. federal entitlement programs from the Revolutionary War, yes, it goes back that far, to modern times. John served under President Reagan in the Department of Labor and the Office of Management and Budget. He's also served on numerous congressional, presidential, and California state advisory commissions. Josh Rao is a senior fellow here at the Hoover Institution, and he is the Ormond Family Professor of Finance at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. Josh studies corporate investment, business taxation, government pension liabilities, and investment management. Josh served in the Trump White House as principal chief economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. John and Josh, it's great to see you today.
Great to be with you, Bill. Josh, I just wish you were in person, but here we are. But thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Bill, for the introduction. And it's great to be here on virtual stage. with you, Bill, and with John Cogan, who is somebody I idolize. So one of my idols. So great to be here.
Yeah, fingers crossed we can do this in person at some point in 2021. We'll just have to wait and see. So, John Cogan, I know why you're smiling today, and that's because you are not doing what you were at this time 20 years ago, which was being in Washington, D.C. and trying to put together a federal budget for the incoming president. I read your paper on UBI, John. It was terrific. No surprise there. Here's what I'm curious about, John. UBI was a hot commodity at one point in the Democratic primaries. This fellow named Andrew Yang, came out of nowhere. His followers were called the Yang Gang, and Mr. Yang proposed what he called the Freedom Dividend, which kind of sounds like Freedom Fries. I remember those French fries became Freedom Fries. But his Freedom Dividend, I think, John, was $1,000 a month, if I'm not mistaken. Mark Zuckerberg thought it was a great idea. Elon Musk thought it was a great idea. But the question, John, is it really feasible? And by that I mean, is enough ever enough when it comes to UBI? And second, and maybe more importantly, John, how would you write a budget if you had to put UBI into it?
Well, both are very good questions. And I have to say, I give a lot of credit to David Yang for resurrecting the idea. You know, it has a very long and illustrious intellectual lineage. Thomas Paine, Milton Friedman, James Tobin have all written about it, advocating it as a replacement for the current system. And in the paper that Danny Heil and I have written for this conference, we analyzed several different UBI plans, one of which is close to, but not exactly the same as Andrew Yang's. And that program would establish a poverty level benefit income guarantee under which no one could fall for every U.S. household. And so that, in that respect, it's very similar to the Yang proposal. Different from Yang is we decided that we would seek to examine its impact if it replaced the entire U.S. Income transfer system, so Social Security, Medicare, and so forth. What we found was that one could finance a UBI that promised to eliminate poverty by eliminating all other government assistance programs, but that the consequences would be very bad for the distribution of income. That is, if you shift money actually away from the poor and towards the upper fifth of the income distribution. We also analyzed a much more practical plan, one that also promised to eliminate poverty, but one that reduced benefits by 50 cents for every dollar that a person earned. And so provide assistance to the typical household of four that had an income of $50,000 or less. We proposed in that plan to replace pretty much the welfare system in the U.S., so cash and with cash benefits. And there we found that the distribution of income would be slightly improved. The labor supply, aggregate labor supply, would be slightly improved. The system would not be self-financing quite. It would run about a $200 billion deficit. And so that plan, we think, is feasible, but for various reasons that we can get into later on, we don't think it's a good plan for it.
Okay, so Josh, what John was doing was he was taking a current pile of money and trying to figure how to redistribute the current pile of money, doing it differently. But the point is, he's doing it with the current pile of money. What if he had more money to play with, which is what Joe Biden has been talking about? His plan, as I read it correctly, Josh, he wants to tax you if you make over $400,000 a year. I think that applies to something like 1.8% of all households in America. You've studied the effect of wealth taxes. Can you do this? Can you just zap it to people making over $400,000 and still be able to pay for a Green New Deal and Medicare for All and anything else that the president-elect wants to put under the Christmas tree?
Well, in the paper that Greg Carney and I have written for this series, we take a look at what the evidence shows about income taxation and wealth taxation. Those are kind of the two ways that the political machine is talking about trying to raise more revenue for some of these left-leaning programs. And it turned up a few interesting facts in our paper that I think need to be emphasized. So, you know, the U.S. has a reputation out there for having low taxes for a developed country. Right. And there is some truth to that when you look at taxes as a percentage of GDP, of gross domestic product. So in 2019, the U.S. spent 38% of GDP, the U.S. government spent 38% of GDP, placing it above countries like Ireland and Chile, which are in the mid-20s, and above Korea, which is around 30, and above Switzerland, which is around 34, but significantly below most OECD countries. So, you know, countries that top off the list are Belgium, where the government spends 52% of GDP, Finland, where it spends 53% of GDP, and France, where it spends 56% of GDP.
Right.
So some people look at that and say, well, looks like the U.S. has room to tax more. But one little recognized fact is that the U.S. actually has one of the most progressive tax systems in the world. Mm-hmm. In fact, as an OECD study from around 10 years ago shows, and this is still true today, if you define progressivity as what share of taxes are paid by the richest 10%, the U.S. was on top of all of the OECD countries that this OECD study looked at. 45% of taxes in the U.S., of all taxes, are paid by the richest 10%. So what is going on? Well, the U.S. tax system already involves quite high marginal tax rates for high earners and is already quite progressive. Mm-hmm. So the lesson that we take away from the historical record and from the international evidence is that if the U.S. does want to have more resources for certain spending priorities that may be rising in political importance right now, it's going to be very hard to do that by taxing upper income people even more. In fact, the only real way that these countries that top off the list of the highest government spending countries in the world, the only real way that they do that is by putting a very big tax burden on the middle class.
Right.
And that's something that you really can't escape. People who are proponents of Medicare for All or the Green New Deal have to recognize that the math simply does not work. Cannot finance these priorities simply by taxing the rich.
A reminder, if you tuned in late, you're watching the Hoover Institute's Human Prosperity Project with John Cogan and Josh Rao. If you like, we're going to do questions from the audience in about 15 minutes or so. So get yours in if you want. Just go to the Q&A button at the bottom of the screen, type away, and we will do our best to get it to our guests. John Cogan, I want to read back to you a passage from your paper and get your thoughts on this. You wrote, and I quote, "Today's federal income transfer system consists of more than 100 separate federal programs that are spread across more than a dozen separate government agencies, each with its own bureaucracy and administrative costs. Income transfer programs have been added in piecemeal fashion over the past 8 decades. Each to meet some specific need at some point in time. The result is a complex web of highly inefficient, often overlapping programs that provide a wide variety of uncoordinated cash and in-kind benefits to persons located in all parts of the U.S. income distribution." John, could UBI simplify this, or could it perhaps spark a conversation? And this is getting in the topic, your very great book on entitlements, but how do you untangle the web?
So, if you ask, why do conservatives support the idea of a UBI? Bill, the passage that you read, which is an indictment of the current income transfer system, is the answer to that question. But we have to go to the next step and ask, would the UBI in a sensible form, affordable form, wouldn't be able to redress the current inefficiencies and improper incentives that are built into the current mind-numbing web, right, of programs. And the answer that Danny and I came up with in our paper is not really. One of the criticisms of the current system, of course, is that the work disincentives that are built into it are quite large.
Right.
But when we analyzed the UBI program with a 50% benefit reduction rate, the practical program, as we call it, the one that followed the proposals offered decades earlier by Richard Nixon and by Jimmy Carter, what we found was that overall, the work disincentives for the economy actually reduced aggregate work effort. And the reason for that is, despite all of the problems with the current system, it does target benefits on individuals, mostly who are not expected to work. Senior citizens, at least the upper half of the senior citizens in terms of age, single moms with children, the disabled, and so forth. Right. And so the work disincentives of the current system, as bad as they are narrowly targeted on a relatively modest group of individuals. A UBI, on the other hand, while reducing the work disincentives of the existing programs that would be replaced, extend the work disincentives throughout a very large large segment of the U.S. population. Mm-hmm. And the extension of work disincentives to that larger group offsets the reduced work disincentives of the much smaller group. A second feature of the UBI is that it alters the distribution of government assistance only slightly. That is, one of the criticisms that you hear about the current system is that so much of the benefits go to the middle class.
Right.
What we found was that under a UBI system, about the same amount of benefits would go to the middle class, so not much of an improvement there. So the basic indictment of the U.S. system, which is bad work disincentives and an inability to target assistance on the needy, neither of those are improved under a UBI system.
Right. So, you know, Josh, your colleague John says those words with such certainty, and John is obviously renowned in what he does, and you're renowned as well. Let me ask you this question. Harry Truman once famously said, "Give me a one-handed economist." Why did Truman say that? Because he said, every time I talk to an economist, they say on one hand and they say, but on the other hand. So he wanted a one-hand economist. Question is this, Josh, and you've written a review article on this. What do economists get right when we talk about taxation, and what do they get wrong? Where do they miss the mark? Let's think of this, if you will, about polling. We've had a lot of conversations about pollsters in this election, but what about economists? What do economists get right and wrong?
Well, that's a big topic of this piece for this project. So I'm glad you asked, and I think that the economics profession, the mainstream economics profession, has been in recent years missing the mark on some of the very important questions that relate to the impact of taxation on economic prosperity. So what has the economics profession done right? Well, I mean, there's a long history of studying taxation and economics. You go back to the 1920s in Cambridge, England, the profession was making some very, very important and maybe what are now somewhat obvious recognitions. The main one being that if you tax an activity, there's going to be less of it unless people can't avoid it or are very reluctant to avoid it. Mm-hmm. And so economists were able to figure out that if all you care about is kind of collecting a certain amount of revenue, there are some ways to do that that would minimize economic damage. Those ways tend to be ingenious, but a lot of them seem unfair and are not always politically popular. So the classic example is a tax on land at unimproved value. Milton Friedman called that the least bad tax. Yet most of the way that we try to, our governments in the Western world are trying to finance their spending priorities seems to be through income and wealth taxation. And here's where things start to get a little bit mixed. So in the 1970s, another British economist, James Merlis, modeled the very important point that if you tax income, you're going to get less of it. Okay, so that's, again, applying the basic principles from from before his time. And that's because people who are capable of earning more income will choose to earn less if there's a very high tax on additional work and, you know, business inputs that they might apply. Mm-hmm. This was kind of vital and brilliant to recognize the fact that that if you tax income, you're going to get less of it. And some good stuff followed that. So one of the good things that followed it was the point made that the tax system might be so distortionary that you might actually get less tax revenue as a government if you raise the income tax rate. That's the Laffer curve. You know, this notion popularized by Art Laffer during the supply side revolution of the 1980s. So great point there. And as they would say in the era of Zoom calls and Zoom chats, plus one for him. The late Marty Feldstein, who was a Hoover fellow, was one of a group of empirical economists who in the 1980s and 90s set out to measure just how much resources we're losing as a society by doing income taxation. And so plus one for him. But since then, a few problematic things have happened. So first of all, mainstream economics has started arguing that these behavioral responses to taxation, contrary to Martin Feldstein's evidence, and also contrary to some recent evidence that I've been producing and that I think is increasingly coming from other corners of the profession, people started arguing that these behavioral responses, the you know, people working less as a result of high taxes, or not forming as many businesses as a result of high taxes, or moving out of high tax jurisdictions as a result of high taxes. Mainstream economics started to argue that those things didn't really matter, that was actually, you know, kind of a sideshow, and that you could raise taxes to a very high extent without distorting economic activity. And furthermore, they put some calibrated models together and started arguing what I think if you polled public finance economists, the median response would be that the optimal tax rate is 70 or 80%. The optimal top marginal income tax rate is 70 or 80%. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is just stunning from my perspective. I think it misses a lot of things. First of all, it misses the evidence that suggests that the Laffer curve peaks much lower than that. But secondly, and this is where I want to, you know, I'll leave it, is that, you know, the top of the Laffer curve is in no sense the prosperity maximizing tax rate. It top of the Laffer curve means you're at the point where literally if the government raises tax rates by another one percentage point, they can't get another dime of tax revenue back because taxpayers respond so dramatically. By the time you get there, you've already discouraged a tremendous amount of economic activity if you're at the top of the Laffer curve. In my research about the state of California, for example, I think, you know, my numbers would suggest that California at this point is at the top or over the top of the Laffer curve on the top marginal income tax rate for high earners, which is now 13.3%. Due to the ability of taxpayers to evade and avoid taxes and to leave the state if necessary. And I think that the profession has kind of gotten it wrong on the magnitude of how high you can tax before you start having major societal consequences. And secondly, just on the point that once you start taxing a lot, you know, if you're at the top of the Laffer curve, you've already destroyed a tremendous amount of economic activity getting there.
Okay, John. Yeah, John, I didn't mean to attack your profession. I hope you didn't take it that way, but what would you like to add to that?
Yeah, so just a little bit on to Josh's terrific answer. You know, Harry Truman wasn't quite wrong when he said, when he talked about the two-handed economist.
Right.
Because economists are always emphasizing trade-offs.
Right.
And Truman was a little bit frustrated with that. And so when we think about taxation, as Josh did, there are trade-offs. You've got to raise the revenues of the finance the government, and you want to do that in the most efficient way possible. But even the most efficient way has a cost to it. In the welfare area or the income transfer area that I work in, you have the same kind of trade-off. You want to provide assistance to help those who are truly in need. But at the same time, when you provide that assistance, you mm-hmm. are automatically creating an incentive against self-improvement. And that's an inescapable trade-off. And I'm sure it frustrated Harry Truman and every other president that heard that kind of advice on tax policy that Josh gave, or what I would say on welfare policy down through the ages.
Right, very good. We have a lot of questions, and we'll get to them in a minute, but I'd like to close out, gentlemen, by talking about California for a moment, if you'd like, the state in which the three of us live. Josh, you've written about California and taxation. I'd refer our audience to a really great white paper you did on this recently. Josh, in the past decade, California has discovered what I would call Robin Hood economics or Robin Hood politics, where you put a tax increase on the ballot and you sell it as sticking it to the rich and giving the money ostensibly to the poor. There were two ballot measures in 2012 and 2016 that did this. There may be one coming down the pike in 2022. Josh, it would raise the personal income tax in California up to 16.3% if you make over $2 million. Gentlemen, you might be aware there was a bill in the legislature last year which kicked around the idea of a wealth tax in California, an estate tax, if you will, if you have more than $30 million in your possession, and it was described as worldwide net worth, not just California money, but what you have around the globe. John Cogan's many homes and chalets he has around the globe, the state would tax you, and they would tax you for a decade. They based on how many years you'd live in California. And if you left California, say, well, you lived here nine of the last 10 years. But Josh, you've written about this. You've talked about what wealth taxes have done to California people's behavior. Explain a little bit of your findings for us.
Right. Well, the work that I've done is looked at the impact of these top bracket marginal income tax rates on high earners. Yeah. So these are the ones that went in that raised the what was previously a 9.3% flat rate plus a 1% surcharge on incomes over $1 million to be 9, 10, 11, and 12.3% plus the additional 1%, which brings the very top rate up to 13.3% for California. And so what we did using tax return data from the state of California was to actually look at what was the response of people to these higher tax rates. And one of the problems that we were facing was, you know, the sort of second decade of the century, 2010 to really to 2019 to pre-COVID was a time of economic recovery at the beginning of that decade, a slow economic recovery, and then accelerating economic recovery in the middle of that decade. And that economic recovery masked a lot of bad stuff that was going on. So the state was able to say, look, yeah, we raised taxes dramatically, you know, from 9% to 13, you know, over 13%. You know, we raised the marginal tax rate by 40% on people. And look, our revenues are still growing. Right. Well, what that casual observation does is it neglects the fact that the economy was really generally booming during this time, and that actually, what our study finds is that had the economy not boomed that way, they would not have taken in nearly as much revenue, and the impact would have been because of this tax increase. Or another way of saying it is that even with this economic boom, they should have been taking in much, much more tax revenue had people not reacted to this tax increase the way they did. How did they react? Well, maybe not surprising anecdotally to a lot of people, but from the data, this is the only study that I know that has shown this, there is a big spike in people leaving the state after Prop 30 was passed in 2012 and went into effect in 2012. And then the second very important point is that people's reported taxable income they were reporting to tax authorities was not as high as one would have expected that it should have been in the absence of this tax increase. So when you compare the patterns of high earners in California to very, very similar looking people in other high tax states like New York State and some other states, you see a divergence after Prop 30, after these higher tax rates, where people are finding ways not to report as much taxable income to the tax authorities in California, either by shifting their business interests around in certain ways, or possibly by simply engaging in less economic activity. And you put these things together, And within the first 2 years after Prop 30, the state was had lost 60% of the tax revenue that they should have collected. Essentially, they weren't at the top of the Laffer curve there, but they were dangerously approaching it. I think what we learned from this is that now that state and local taxes are no longer deductible against the federal tax code, right, now we're talking about even greater tax increases. I think it seems quite plausible that the state of California is at the top of the Laffer curve, which, as I would mention, I just remind you, is that top of the Laffer curve is the point where the government is totally tapped out and can't raise another dollar of revenue from the income tax base by raising tax rates. It's way past the point of prosperity maximizing tax rates, which would be a much, much lower tax rate.
Right, John. I know if you chase wealth in California, people worth over $30 million, you're talking about a colony of about 30,000 people in a state of 40 million people. The advocates of this, John, say they'll raise $7.5 billion. But if you look at the shortfall in K-12 and community colleges, the champions who want to fill that bucket say that's more $20 billion. So you've done budget math for a living before. How do you rectify $7.5 billion to a $20 billion needs? In other words, where else would you go hunting for money?
Well, as Josh said, California is pretty close to capped out in terms of income tax revenues. And just to drive the point home about the people voting with their feet outside of California when taxes rise, we all saw the news just this week that Hewlett-Packard has decided to move its headquarters out of California. Last year, the Charles Schwab Corporation, another great company for California, announced that it was going to move its headquarters.
Right.
So you're seeing the exodus at the company level that Josh spoke about at the individual level. And so I don't think that the revenues are the answer here. And the answer is you've got to look at how we're spending the money that we do. Years ago, we passed a proposition which gives our K-12 education system automatically 40% of all of the state revenue. Mm-hmm. What that has meant is that the legislature each year just passes on from one bill to the next without ever thinking about education, because the spending is automatic. And so the quality of those expenditures or the effectiveness of those expenditures doesn't get assessed regularly by the legislature. And of course, what's happened to K-12 education in California, the quality is diminished extraordinarily. Same thing is true with the Medicaid program, the Medi-Cal program. It's on automatic pilot. The government spends as much as it has to provide assistance to individuals, and there's very little review of that work. Another example might be the unemployment insurance system, which has been just shown to be so fraudulent as a consequence of the response to the COVID. So where to go? Go to where the money is in the budget and see how we can spend our money more wisely and more efficiently for taxpayers.
Yeah, I would point out to you, John and Josh, that when Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, went on TV to thank HP for deciding to move to Houston, he cited three things that Texas has. He cited, number one, a very talented workforce, cited, number two, a great public university system, and number three, a very business-friendly tax and regulatory climate. You figure which of those three California does not have. Okay, would you guys like to take some audience questions? We have about 15 minutes here, so... willing to do a few audience questions for us?
Great.
Okay, let's start with a question from Roy. Please ask either Mr. Kogan or Mr. Rao why we don't reduce corporate tax rates to zero, and wouldn't that spur investment and job growth unseen in decades? I'm taking the position with my question that corporations are merely tax collectors and pass along the cost to the consumer.
Josh, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Well, I would certainly be in favor of those types of corporate tax cuts, and I've done some studying of this issue myself. If you want to know the answer to the question, why don't other people agree with us? It has to do with what you believe the research shows about the incidence of corporate tax rates, meaning, where does it fall? Who pays the burden? And I think that when you look at the evidence, the evidence is pretty strong that the burden of corporate taxes is paid heavily by people like workers and consumers, and not as much by the capitalists, so to speak, because the capitalists are generally able to move their activity to other places or undertake actions that reduce the burden that they're going to pay on the tax. And so as a result, as you said, Roy, passing it through to others, that's the reason why the corporate tax rate should be much lower than it is, and yet it isn't. Now, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act still reduced the tax rate for U.S. corporations from a kind of OECD high, statutory high of 35% down to 22%. So some progress was made there. But in general, I think the evidence shows that the corporate tax is a very inefficient way to raise income. It also does not fall on the people who you think it actually falls on.
Right. You know, Bill, just to follow up on what Josh said, back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan went to a bar, I believe it was in Boston, and sat down with his blue-collar workers, and he told them that corporations don't pay taxes. And Josh has just made the point very well. Corporations really don't pay taxes. They're just pass-through entities. And the ultimate tax burden falls on workers, on pensioners, and on consumers. The economics that Josh cited, and I just want to emphasize one of the points he made, economics of it are that the best way to improve worker productivity that would allow us to compete better in this internationally competitive world is to reduce the corporate tax. What studies have shown is that reductions in the corporate tax allow companies to invest more in their workers, and ultimately that's what leads to greater productivity.
Right. We have a question from Shirley Matson. Hi, Shirley. Shirley writes, Representative Ocasio-Cortez is selling sweatshirts that say tax the rich. As you point out, Josh, the top tax rate percentage is already paying 45% of the revenues in the U.S. How will Joe Biden resist this kind of pressure? And how are we going to dig ourselves out of the debt caused by the deficit spending the pandemic has caused? So somebody want to read Joe Biden's mind, and somebody want to tell us how to pay for all the money we just spent.
You know, Ocasio-Cortez is a gift that keeps giving, I think. You know, every one of her proposals that I have seen so far, from the tax hike on the rich to her Green New Deal to the labor policies that she has proposed, are counterproductive to economic growth.
Right.
If anything this country needs right now, it's strong economic growth. Ultimately, that's what creates a higher standard of living. And all of her proposals, even though one might agree with some of the goals of her proposals, perhaps in the environmental area or others, have an enormous cost associated with them that do not justify the benefits of the programs themselves.
Okay.
I'd add there, you know, and that's exactly right. And there are reasons to be worried. There is a Pew Research Center survey that where a large majority of the surveyed Americans, 86%, favored the government raising taxes on quote unquote the wealthiest Americans, mm-hmm. while rather few, 12%, favored raising taxes on quote unquote people like them.
Right.
So tax the rich is becoming something of, you know, it's something that people want to hear. It seems to be a form of opium for the people. I think that in order to resist this, we have to do a better job of conveying how short-sighted
right.
a rob the rich goal is. You know, these types of revolutions never work out well for the people in the medium to long, you know, long run or even the medium run. You know, people need jobs, and for jobs need to be created, there needs to be an incentive for businesses to grow, and that doesn't happen under these kinds of confiscatory tax systems.
Right. Let me ask you both kind of an arbitrary question. I woke up this morning thinking what it is to be wealthy, what it would be like, And I thought, okay, if I were in the situation where I had wealth, what would I do? I'd probably buy a home for myself in downtown Palo Alto so I could walk to work. This is in a very fantasy world where I not only am wealthy, but also we're open for business at the Hoover Institution. But I would either walk or ride my bike to work. And I found a very nice place to live. It's right around the corner from the Whole Foods in Palo Alto. It's an easy walk over to the restaurants on University Avenue. It's a short walk to the train station. That's the good news. Now let's go to the bad news. It is two beds, 1,270 square feet. The asking price is $1.875 million. Josh and John, which translates to about a $9,000 mortgage. If you make $250,000 in California and you lose over half your money in taxes to begin with, that means that you're pretty much wiped out. You take over about $10,000 a month. That means your mortgage eats it up. This raises the question to me of how you two would define wealth. Now, politicians do it arbitrarily. $400,000 is the target this time. Barack Obama was $1 million, but really ended up being about $250,000. But just in your estimation, and yeah, this is a moving target state to state, but what, when you think of wealth, where do you guys ballpark it?
You know, I think that's a bad way to pose the question, Bill, actually. an individual's income and their wealth varies incredibly over their life cycle. You look at people who are age 22 and ask, what is their wealth? What is their income? Half of them are in school. Their income is low. They're in debt. They have no wealth. Right. Check with the same people when they're 42. And they've got that, maybe not that house in Palo Alto, but they've got a house with a mortgage. Their net wealth is not all that great. Check with them at age 60, 65, and they've got a significant amount of wealth and a significant amount of income. And so this idea that there we should be thinking about an individual's wealth as being an individual as being wealthy because they're above or below some level, to me, is not a very good way to think about public policy. The second point I would make with respect to that is that when you think about inequality of wealth or inequality of income, I think about mobility. Don't think about it in a static sense. Think about how easily individuals are able to move from a lower part of the income distribution to a higher part of that income distribution. I think that's where the focus should be.
I concur. I think that it's important to recognize, as John said, that over the lifetime of an individual, that individual is going to be in very, very different parts of the income distribution, and you know, the failure to recognize that often leads to pretty great mistakes. I'll say, from the perspective of the general public, the definition of wealth seems to be anybody who is wealthier than the individual answering the survey, and that's what is dangerous about the current situation. And I think what makes also the Human Prosperity Project extremely important is that it's something, this is an opportunity for us to work on conveying the point, to make people understand that confiscatory taxation that erodes property rights, that worries investors, that leads to a situation where businesses don't want to invest, don't want to grow, don't want to create new jobs. It might deliver some kind of small pop in the short run, although it is frankly a drop in the bucket compared to the kinds of dollars that would be required to fund a Medicare for All or something like that. It might deliver us some kind of pop in the short run. But over the long run, if there's a wealth tax imposed and a 40% exit tax if you try to renounce your U.S. citizenship to get out of that, do you really think people are going to invest in growing their wealth in the United States ever again? Or do you think they're going to invest in hiring lawyers and accountants to make sure that wherever they are, that wealth is going to be built up in some other country where they're not subject to these taxes? So I think there's a lot of short-term focus here that in the political debate that's really focused on political gain, and that's really, really dangerous for long-run prosperity.
Okay, I'd like to roll two questions.
A point, if I could, on one additional point on these higher confiscatory tax rates that Ocasio-Cortez has been recommended. Milton Friedman once said that the way we should think about the tax system in socialism is the higher the tax rate, the closer we get to socialism. Mm-hmm. His point was that when you have a tax rate of 100%, you've achieved socialism. And of course, nothing gets produced because nobody has any incentive to do so. Right. But it was a good way of thinking about gradual movements towards socialism. Mm-hmm. The second point is a more practical one. What we found over the years is that taxes on the middle class tend to follow the top tax rate. So when you raise the top tax rate, ultimately down the road, you inevitably see pressures to raise middle class taxes. And so I would say to most of our audience, beware of these proposals to raise the top rate for that reason. It used to be a saying in Washington, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the fellow behind the tree, right? And now the rich guy is the guy behind the tree. But soon enough, the middle class will be behind the tree.
I'd like to merge two questions into one here since we're running short on time. A question from Vinay. I apologize if I just butchered your name. Vinay asks, is COVID-19 the right time for UBI when already U.S. economy is constrained by massive fiscal and monetary stimulus and there is no room for fiscal profligacy? And then a question from Sylvia. How do the income redistribution programs affect motivation to work? If we increase this amount, will we not incentivize people just to go on welfare?
Well, the answer to both questions is incentives really matter. Mm-hmm. And a UBI program, regardless of whether it's now during the COVID crisis or in some good economic times, extends work disincentives to a greater segment of the U.S. population than the current system of transfer payments do.
Right.
And so in the end, the consequence will be less work, lower GDP, less economic growth. So on net, regardless of whether it's done during COVID crisis or during good times, it's going to be ultimately harmful to the U.S. economy.
Will do. Josh, any thoughts?
I think incentives matter a tremendous amount. And I also, you know, in terms of being, you know, spending, I think the question highlights the fact that, you know, it would have been good if we had thought about some of these questions before really what I would describe as being pretty indiscriminate spending in trying to address the COVID-19 crisis. Not very well targeted. And spending that bails out a lot of, indirectly bails out a lot of investor interests in a lot of parts of the economy. Not saying the federal government shouldn't have done anything at all, but there was a lot of indiscriminate spending there. And I think that at some point, we need to think about, you know, if we do have any goals in the future, whether it's for spending programs or for tax cuts or something, that there has to be a point where we recognize that we can't just, you know, wait for every 10 years to be a major crisis and then spend tremendous amounts of money in the economy. We're also running deficits in the meantime. John is one of the world's experts on these issues, and so I imagine that you would agree with me, John.
I do, and you just made a very important point here, Josh, that I want to echo. As we come out of the COVID crisis, we're going to come out with an enormous federal budget deficit. Going into the crisis, the federal budget deficit was $1 trillion a year and rising. And so it's going to be even larger as we come out. One of the mistakes that we made in coming out of the Great Recession a decade ago is we didn't prepare for the next crisis. Another crisis was coming, either an economic crisis or a healthcare crisis, but it was coming. And our federal government, to Josh's point, be it through Congress and spending or through the Federal Reserve, neither of those institutions prepared for the next economic emergency. And right. So as we come out of this economic emergency, it behooves us to think about how we prepare fiscally for the next.
Okay, we have time for one more question. It comes from our colleague, Tom Gilligan. Hey, Tom. And this question is pretty appropriate here. It's a little off topic, but it's appropriate because it does tie into entitlements and it ties into wealth. And what Tom asks is, what are your views on forgiveness of student debt? Is this a sensible federal entitlement? That's a great question because this is going to be, you know, something facing Joe Biden as soon as he takes office. And there'll be a fairness question. If you racked up a couple hundred thousand dollars of debt from Harvard, should be forgiven. So John and Josh, take this in terms of federal entitlement and also how it pertains to the wealthy.
So in terms of fairness, I'm not sure one should think about it as being fair in the sense that individuals that have already paid off their student loans, I'm actually going to view this as a benefit that they should have received as well, and hence unfair gratuity. But moving away from fairness, I guess I would ask, what are the incentive effects of having a forgiveness plan like that which has been proposed? And the answer is not very good at all. It'll induce many individuals to try to undertake an education program that's not really suited for them, only because it's going to appear to be free, because down the road, they will, in all probability, get their loans forgiven. So I think the incentive effects are very, very bad here, just as they would be for forgiving a loan to a bank. A government loan to a bank creates moral hazard. Same thing with loans to individuals.
So Tom asks, it's sensible, John, and it sounds like you're saying this is not sensible. Okay. Josh, your thoughts?
Or is it fair?
Yeah, or is it fair, Josh?
Yeah, couldn't have said it better. And I think to pick up on the incentives point that John was making, people need an incentive to invest in the right kind of human capital. And I actually fear that right now there has been a lot of misallocation of investment in certain types of human capital. There are a lot of people out there that have large amounts of student debt. And the reason is that they invested in a degree, or they invested in a degree through loans, or taking out loans that really didn't have much of a return or any return. And that's a problem that goes beyond just the problem of sort of the individual financial problems of households. That's a societal problem. And so, in addition to these bad incentives potentially, affecting the direct finances of people who are going to go to college in the future, and in addition to it being unfair, it also makes worse, I think, a problem that we have right now in our education system, which is that people might not be getting the optimal degrees and training that would optimize their human capital, that would lead to a situation where they can lead a prosperous life. And by having sort of a system where you can continue to take out large loans and then have those loans forgiven, in order to do that, you're not incentivizing the kind of activity that leads to economic prosperity.
Well, John and Josh, I want to thank you very much for your time today. You guys were a hit. There were a lot of questions we couldn't get to today. I'm sorry if you did ask a question, we didn't get around to it. Maybe we get these two brilliant economists back and we talk some more about this. So guys, would you be game to that?
Thank you. And Bill, just said to tell the audience, if they have any questions whatsoever, send them to Josh.
We'll then send them to John Cogan. I do want to apologize for one other thing, folks. I know some of you have written to us telling that you've been trying to look up John and Josh's papers online. You've not been able to find them. I apologize. We're still in the final phases of reviewing them and making sure they're clean. They will be online. They'll be online probably about a week from now or so, just a guess. But go look for it then, and you can find it again at hoover.org/humanprosperityproject. We will be doing these, by the way, in 2021. We haven't set any dates, but we will be in touch with you in January when we do set times and dates. So we enjoy you. Hope these conversations, and please keep up with us. And again, the website, hoover.org/humanprosperityproject. A final note before we end this broadcast, and it is a melancholy one. The Hoover Institution suffered a great loss last week, the passing of Dr. Edward Lazier, a renowned economist, the Morris Arnold and Nona Jean Cox Senior Fellow here at the Hoover Institution, the Davies Family Professor of Economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business, and the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors during the administration of George W. Bush. Eddie Lazier loved ideas. He loved economics, and he loved the personal and intellectual reward that comes from teaching. If there's such a thing as a consolation in moments like this, it's knowing that Eddie's legacy lives on. It lives on in his insightful thoughts and words that you can find at our website, hoover.org. It lives on in the hearts and minds of the next generation of economists, the next John Kogans and Josh Rouse, men and women fortunate enough to have taken Eddie's classes. And Eddie Lazier's legacy lives on in these broadcasts. Eddie was a co-founder of the Hoover Institution's Human Prosperity Project because he saw the need for intelligent conversations about capitalism and socialism and their effects on human welfare and liberty. These conversations will continue next year, and challenging though it will be, we'll all just have to work a little harder to live up to the standards that Eddie Lazier set for us. It's how we choose to honor the man. Godspeed, Eddie. Thanks for watching.